failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Today we're going back to Long Beach to the Drug Policy Alliance Conference and hear some of the good words of some of the good people who were in attendance. One of the newest members of law enforcement against prohibition, Mr. Norm Stamper.
We're here in Long Beach at the Westin, and I'm speaking with the former police chief of Seattle, a couple of other cities as well, I believe. We'll get him to tell us more. Decades of experience in law enforcement and the author of the new book, Breaking Rank, Mr. Norm Stamper. Hello, sir.
Hello. How are you?
Norm, we talked together about 4 or 5 months ago. I believe your book tour was really getting started, and things have really built up over that time. Tell us about these past several months.
Well, they have been kind of heady for me. I was hoping that this book would be read by people who care about crime and justice in this country, and I'm just been very flattered and gratified that a whole lot of people are reading the book.
Now, it was just a short time after we talked that you had a discussion with Mr. Jack Cole, and strange thing is, since you joined just a few short months ago, more than 1,000 new members have also joined LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Tell us about that association.
Well, I think police officers are clearly, with the possible exception of those who use drugs and have been on the receiving end of what we'll call drug enforcement, are just in a wonderful position to see the folly of the drug war, the multiple lunacies of this drug war. And so just a short period of time ago became my privilege to join the organization called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And I'm just so pleased that our membership is growing by leaps and bounds, day by day and week by week. Jack Cole, who is the executive director of LEAP, is interested in getting us 10,000 members in roughly a year's time, and 1 million friends of LEAP as well, which gives us then some considerable political clout.
Now, the name of the organization itself says quite a bit. But if you will, perhaps elaborate for those who aren't familiar with your organization, what is the goals, the objectives of LEAP?
The goal, put simply, is to end prohibition, is to put a stop to a public policy that, in my judgment, has been the worst public policy since slavery. And in some respects, there are certain analogies that I think need to be drawn. So much of this war has been waged against people of color, and especially African Americans. So in a word, we want to see prohibition ended.
The working cop can't talk about this. Let's talk about why he can't talk about it.
The culture of policing is a closed culture. Police officers will tell you that unless you've been in my shoes, you can't possibly understand the work, the nature of the work, the obstacles to effectiveness and so forth, the tendency on the part of police officers to believe that they're doing it alone, that they're the only crime fighters on the planet, when in fact authentic partnerships between the community and the police create for far safer neighborhoods and communities. But once again, I think cops are reluctant to speak out because they know that whatever they do say is going to be judged by their peers or perhaps by their superiors. So an individual cop who, for example, believes that the drug war is nuts and says so is likely to be stigmatized and possibly even exiled, perhaps losing a promotion, the day job that he or she wanted. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that the paramilitary bureaucratic organization that is America's police departments will come down hard on that maverick cop. When the truth is, there are a lot of cops who believe the same way I do, for example, about the drug war.
Given the circumstance, the retribution, if you will, that you've described here, it's hard for the cop to do that, any junior district attorney. or even a judge behind the bench. They can't speak of this once they've pinned on that badge, put on that robe. How do we break that system?
Well, I think there are grounds on which we argue the war on drugs. There are the economic grounds, which are compelling. There are the moral grounds, which from my point of view are even more important in the long run, simply because of the human toll that's been taken by this war on drugs. And there was one branch of the government, namely the lawmaking branch, that you didn't mention, that probably affords us the greatest promise, because the cops are enforcing laws that we've imposed on them. The cops are on the front line of this unwinnable, unpopular war. Prosecutors have an obligation to prosecute cases. Judges have an obligation to try them, and upon conviction to hand down their sentences. But none of that would play out. None of that would, in the future, offer even a slim slice of the job descriptions of police officers and prosecutors and judges if lawmakers would say, it's time. It's time to get real, to understand that prohibition never has worked, isn't working today, never will work. Get on about the business of developing regulated legalization so that the drug war ends suddenly, and in its place comes a much more effective, much cheaper, and much more human approach to dealing with the drug issue in this country.
Now, I've heard many say the day we regulate the distribution to adults, and, you know, there's a whole litany of good things happening one day, disrupt the terrorist organization funding, probably destroy the cartels, get rid of most of the violent gangs. Is there a downside? How can this not be more prevalent in the mass media? Why can they not look at this? You've brought the subject up over the airwaves of America. Your thoughts on that?
I think, the media, here's one of the interesting things to me as I've observed reactions to my statements in the last several months, statements particularly on the drug war. I think the media is always interested in controversial issues. People get exercised, their veins start popping in their necks when they get into subjects that upon which there's disagreement. And one of the things that comes up for me is that those of us who are anti-war activists, if you will, have got to do is reach out to these hot media. And I'm talking about whether it comes from the left or the right, talk shows and television appearances that would drive this message home to an awful lot more people. One-on-one conversations, one-on-one kind of education is valuable, but we need to reach masses of people. And you do that, I think, through the mass communication media.
Well, and again, you, I heard, had a couple of three opportunities just a week or so ago on, was it MSNBC and a couple of others, to share this truth with America. Was there any response? Were you made aware of anybody responding to statements made?
Well, I was on the O'Reilly Factor, and of course he was a horse's ass from my point of view, but he always is, and he's very friendly before and very friendly after, but while he's on, he's performing. It's not a legitimate, if you will, interview that takes place. He would, for example, ask a question and then answer it himself in two or three parts. And he summarized our time together by saying that I lived in a fairyland. So he was clearly discrediting both the message and the messenger. Nonetheless, as a result of that appearance, Leap got a whole lot of new members. I was on Tucker Carlson's The Situation, I think it's called, on MSNBC. I appeared on In the Money, which is a show that usually wouldn't address this issue, on CNN. And I think it's safe to say that after each of those appearances, we have seen greater interest, greater support, people signing on as anti-drug war activists. And that was, for me, very, very encouraging.
Well, you bet. I read the radio trade papers once in a while, and I see they're looking for a good, liberal, adult you know, talk show, something to compete with the Hannitys and the O'Reillys. And I guarantee they could put me in Podunk, Kansas, in a prison town, and we'd run the Arbitrons through the roof. What do you think?
I think that's true. I think America is ripe for the other side, if you will. The conservative media in this country, that perhaps that's a euphemism, probably is, for the radical right wing of the public media, have basically had their way, had their day for years now. And whether it's Air America, your show, other approaches and shows, both radio and television, that present that alternating view, I think the American public is ready to hear it.
I understand from talking with representatives of LEAP, which is on the web at leap.cc, that they've now grown their numbers to some 4,500 strong following the involvement from the folks in Long Beach.
We're here in Long Beach. We just came from a seminar talking about legalization and what it might look like. And I have with me at this time Jillian Maxwell out of British Columbia and Danny Kushlick out of Bristol, UK. If you will, please, starting with you, Jillian, tell us about your organization. What brought you to this conference?
Okay, my organization is called Keeping the Door Open, Dialogues on Drug Use. And that's exactly what we do. We promote dialogues around drug use that further enhances changing drug policy. And we just pick issues that we think will be useful for that end.
All right, sir. And Danny, your organization?
We're a national charity campaigning for the repeal of prohibition and its replacement with an effective system of regulation and control. We're calling for the legalization of all drugs.
Your thoughts, starting with you, Jillian, what do you see, the future of legalization? How will it come about? What will be the end product, so to speak?
Well, I don't think it's really what Gillian Maxwell thinks that's terribly important, but the group that I represent today, and I have been discussing this for quite a while, and we have provincial health officers, medical health officers, who advise government on policy in British Columbia, and they've come out with this really quite exciting paper, a discussion paper, definitely, but they're making recommendations, definitely, that prohibition is a total failure and has to end, and to put in its place some kind of a regulatory model. And what we're saying, which actually we've borrowed from Transform UK, is the ultimate question everybody has to ask themselves is, who would you rather be in control of distribution of drugs in our society, public health officers or organized crime? That usually stops them dead in their tracks.
And you, Danny?
I can very much agree with where Gillian and Keeping Door Open is where they're coming from. Our view is that we've now reached a point in the drug law reform movement where it's not good enough just to say we want to repeal prohibition and replace it with something and leave it to somebody else to sort out. Our view is that we have the expertise, we have the experience, we have some incredibly bright people, not only from Vancouver, from King County Bar Association, but within the DPA and within the cannabis movement. People have been thinking about this stuff for years, but nobody's actually brought it all together and made a definitive, produced a definitive publication and a definitive statement on how the hell we're going to do this. On the one hand, this is actually fairly simple, because ultimately legalization is either going to the doctors or it's going shopping. But the detail of how that works, whether the pharmaceutical industry does it, what's the state's involvement, what are the age restrictions on this kind of stuff, all those things need to be worked out. It shouldn't take that long, and we're hoping that Transform are planning to produce a document by the end of 2006 that will pretty much show how the whole thing works, at least in terms of opportunities. We're not expecting Saudi Arabia to adopt the same policies as the UK, but what it will provide is a series of options that people can look at and decide whether they prefer to leave things as they are, whether they prefer prohibition to remain in place, or to see something that is very pragmatic, that is very effective, and that is evidence-based, that we know that works from all the history that we have of legalization.
You mentioned earlier that Transform has projected a date a time frame for the end of Prohibition. Tell us about that.
We took a decision at the point. We produced a document last year called After the War on Drugs, Options for Control. As part of that process, we decided that it was going to be worthwhile to put in a schedule of how long it might take to do this from year zero, as it were. So our decision was to pick 2020, as a date by which we could realistically expect to have undone the international conventions as they stand, to have repealed prohibition globally and replaced it with an effective system of regulation and control. Now, the beauty of doing this is, firstly, that I haven't met anyone yet who balks at the idea that 15 years is an unreasonable timescale to be looking at. So we think it's reasonable, we think it's realistic. But the second part of this is that once you set your deadline, people have got to start working to keep on schedule. So there are certain things that need to happen by 2008, by 2010, by 2015, in order to keep us on track, in order to reach the prize of securing a rewritten single convention on drugs and an opportunity for nation states to determine as domestically how they deal with drugs. Now, what we're hoping is that other members of the drug law reform movement, both individuals and organizations, will buy into this, and that we can then start working collaboratively on a political strategy to actually achieve this. At the moment, there's a kind of abstract view of the glorious day will come at some point in the future, but God knows when. Once you nail it, everyone's got to start working towards it. And if they don't want to start working towards it, then they'd better say why.
I think what I've heard from this conference is people's willingness to talk about that they can now use the word legalize rather openly. It has become okay to talk about. What's your thought, Jillian? Is this willingness to say the word legalize a message of hope?
Well, it is. I was just thinking before you asked me that question about that very thing. And in BC, in British Columbia, we're talking about regulating and a regulated market. It just, because when you say legalize, I'm not too sure that I agree with you that it's kind of commonplace to talk about it. People tend to just freak out. And because it implies that you're going to be sort of having, as somebody said this morning, crystal meth and vending machines in schools. Of course, that's never going to happen. But you know, people go to extremes and go, well, then we can never talk about this. So we're suggesting we say, let's just talk about regulation and what regulation would look like. And whether that's a tight set of regulations or a very broad set, there has to be. We have regulations. We have to have them. We're clear that we don't want small children accessing drugs easily, or even we don't want people in schools promoting drugs to kids. So there's certain parameters I think we all agree on where regulations are needed. And we had a very interesting discussion in the seminar this morning about is regulation too tight? Don't you have to have some kind of sort of advertising so that people and kids are aware of what they're taking? All of those things really have to be discussed in the next year or two, and then we have to come up with a plan that I think different jurisdictions can work with and say, okay, I like that part and that part. And then you have to go out into your communities and start to do some focus, what is that called, social marketing, where you do focus groups and you talk to different specific groups, find out what their issues are, and start to get them comfortable with the ideas. There's many different levels to work at promoting this, and to eventually end up with changing the big laws at the UN. You have to have that going on at the top, and you have to have the community discussions going on at the same time.
If you would share with us your website, maybe folks could learn more about your work. Let's start with you, Dan.
Could I just say something else?
Sure, please do. Please
throw something in on that.
Yes.
I take great hope from the fact that people are willing to talk about legalization. It has been a taboo amongst, certainly in the U.S., up until fairly recently, and almost the party line was don't talk about legalization, only talk about control and regulation. Two things on that, though. One is that legalization is a process, not an outcome. And it's something that only became clear to me a little while ago. We're a campaign for the control and regulation of drugs, not a campaign for legalization. What we want to see is currently prohibited drugs legally controlled and regulated. Now, the process by which we get there happens to be legalization. But that's an ideological position. So we're not ideologues. What we're out for is a better world where drugs are controlled and regulated, not one where we win arguments and can champion a cause and say the L word when and where we want. This is about making the world a better place in which to live. Secondly, just in terms of the UK, there's a conservative leadership contest going on at the moment, and one of the contenders is a young guy called David Cameron, who, when he served on the Home Affairs Select Committee, a cross-party group running a drugs inquiry in 2001-2002, one of the recommendations was to call upon the UK government to initiate a discussion at the UN on alternatives to prohibition, including the legalisation of drugs. And at that point, it almost made it okay. And now that we're in a position now where he could be the next leader of the Conservative Party, so we could have an out-legaliser who's actually heading up the second largest party in the UK. So there's a lot of things that are leading to that certainly give us an enormous amount of hope. If people want to find out more about this stuff and see where the UK's at, our website is www.tdpf.org.uk, transformdrugpolicyfoundation.org.uk. Check it out.
And you, Gillian, some closing comments and maybe your website?
Sure. I agree. What was identified to us several years ago is that we really need to find a champion and a political champion to really move this issue forward. And we have a few in Canada. We have a senator who actually is a Conservative appointed senator who headed up a committee that went around Canada and came up with, it was supposed to be on all drugs, and then he was restricted to cannabis, but he did recommend legalization of cannabis, and in fact he also recommends legalization of all drugs. And our two mayors, the previous mayor and the current mayor of Vancouver, where we live, have both campaigned for the four pillars approach, harm reduction, and now our current mayor, who is a former cop, totally is in support of legalization. And he is now retiring as a mayor, and he's going to be in the Senate as well. So there is a lot of support there, but I would love to have the leader of a party, whether they're in the government or not, be speaking openly in the Houses of Parliament, which is really the most where the action really is. So we're going to be looking for that person soon. Certainly, everybody's welcome to visit us on our website. We're called Keeping the Door Open Dialogues on Drug Use, and the website address is www.keepingthedooropen.com.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's little sojourn to Long Beach. We'll have more of that and additional Drug Truth Network programs in the next week or three. I'm headed to Vancouver, Canada. And speaking of which, here's Mr. Mark Emery.
My name is Mark Emery. I'm publisher of Cannabis Culture, and according to the DEA, I am the number one drug trafficking organization kingpin in all of Canada. And so I'm perhaps the Canada's most recognized activist and drug lord and kingpin and DEA target. So it makes Vancouver action central.
Well, Mark, if my passport will get me across the border, I'm going to come see you in the next few days. And what can I expect in Canada? What differences are there between your country and mine?
Well, the difference typically is in enforcement and in the judiciary. Vancouver particularly is a community made up of a lot of people from out of town, and it's very much a laid-back kind of city, Ocean City, a lot of gay people here, a lot of Chinese people, a lot of people from all over the world, a lot of weed here and a lot of weed people.
Now, I know there's got to be a large difference between the city of Houston, where I'm from, and the city of Vancouver, where you're based. We arrest 90 people every day for drugs here. What's it like there?
Well, we arrest a lot of people for drugs in Canada, too, except that they don't get the harsh penalties they do in the United States. The United States has 500,000 people in jail for nonviolent drug offenses, including 100,000 marijuana people. Proportionately, if that were the same in Canada, we'd have to have 50,000 nonviolent drug offenders in jail. And we don't even have that many people in total in the entire prison system in Canada. We have about 36,000 people in prison. So it's about 1/13 of the United States. And, of course, we have 1/10 of the population. But the United States has 2.5 million people in prison. You have 7 times more people in jails than we do by population. 70 times more in absolute numbers and 7 times more in proportionate numbers.
Mark Emery and Cannabis Culture, along with Cultural Baggage, are going to do a joint radio pot TV program, and while I'm up there, I intend to visit the Naomi Project, that's the heroin maintenance sites, as well as the safe injection sites, and to take a general tour of the place, you know, get a feel for the place. I'll then be headed to Seattle to attend the Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs Conference, an international conference. The end is near, my friends. It draws nearer when you speak up, when you stand up, when you shout it out, no more drug war.
The drug czar claimed victory in the cocaine wars late last week. In a press briefing on November 17th, John Walters asserted that at the retail level, cocaine prices had risen and average purity had fallen between February and September of 2005. The czar even presented data showing 2 years' worth of quarterly price and purity fluctuations to support his claim. The czar didn't show the data from the previous 2 decades. There are actually fluctuations in price and purity every quarter. The changes he touted were well within the normal range of the past several years. In any event, the prices are much lower and the purity higher than they were in the 1980s. Our government claims that this new data shows the success of the Andean Counter-Drug Initiative, also called Plan Colombia. Yet it's more likely this shows the impact of rising fuel prices on transportation costs. Even cocaine dealers have to buy gasoline. Copies of the czar's presentation, as well as earlier federal price and purity data, are available from the Common Sense website at commonsensedrugpolicy.org. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org.
It's made of doorknob handles and covered with mayonnaise. It's faster than grease lightning, and it'll be your end of days. It's a slippery slope.
Ah, yes, the proverbial slippery slope. A puff might lead to a pill, might lead to a needle, might lead to disease, destruction, and death. Never mind that more kids get killed playing football and other sports, more are injured by beatings from drunken fathers, that more kids get in trouble for possession than for any other reason. Never mind the millions of kids that will be hurtling down mountainsides this winter, on sleds, skis, snowboards, cardboard boxes, saucers, and other devices meant to take advantage of gravity and slippery slopes. Do we need Mama Government and Papa John the Drug Czar to watch over every detail of our lives? After 91 years of abject failure in this drug war, with drugs cheaper, purer, and more readily available to our children than ever before, do we need him to watch over our children? Do we need them to decide what is a slippery slope and to penalize us for taking the plunge? The true slippery slope is the Interstate Commerce Clause and the Controlled Substances Act, which working together threaten every bulwark of democracy and human rights crafted and fought for by millions of Americans over the centuries. I say it once again, there is nobody in government, in the corporate media, in science, in medicine, within the clergy, absolutely nobody on planet Earth who is able to defend the policy of drug prohibition with me, right here on the Drug Truth Network. There is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, or religious underpinnings to this drug war. None. Zero. Zilch. We have been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Please do your part to help end this inquisition. Visit our website, inprohibition.org. Prohibido istak ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guffman.